Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the surprise election result in France that has put left-wing coalition, the New Popular Front, on top. So who are the left leaders? What do they want? And what does this result mean for French President Emmanuel Macron? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 10th of July, these are our main stories. NATO members are in Washington to mark the alliance's 75th birthday and to discuss support for Ukraine. The Democratic leader in the House of Representatives holds a crisis meeting on President Biden's re-election bid. A Russian court issues an arrest warrant for Yulia Navalny, 5 months after the death of her husband, Alexei Navalny, in prison. Also in this podcast, we hear from two victims of FGM who underwent reconstructive surgery in Europe. And...
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, top! Allumage 2 ESR, décollage!
The European Space Agency successfully launches its new Ariane 6 rocket. NATO members have begun a 3-day summit to mark its 75th birthday. It comes just a day after Monday's ferocious series of attacks on Ukraine, which left the country's largest children's hospital in ruins. World leaders have condemned the strikes on civilians, which killed 42 people, although Moscow denies the hospital in Kyiv was hit by a Russian cruise missile. Ukraine is high on the NATO agenda at the summit, which President Biden emphasized in his opening remarks.
Make no mistake, Russia is failing in this war. More than 2 years into Putin's war of choice, his losses are staggering. More than 350,000 Russian troops dead or wounded. Nearly 1 million Russians, many of them young people, have left Russia because they no longer see a future in Russia. And Kyiv, remember, fellas and ladies, supposed to fall in 5 days, remember? Was still standing 2.5 years later and will continue to stand. All of the Allies knew that before this war, Putin thought NATO would break. Today, NATO is stronger than it's ever been in its history. When this senseless war began, Ukraine was a free country. Today, it is still a free country. And the war will end with Ukraine remaining a free and independent country. Russia will not prevail. Ukraine will prevail.
President Biden. Well, arriving in Washington in the U.S., Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said he'd be appealing for more sustained security guarantees. Earlier, I spoke to our defense correspondent, Jonathan Beale, who's at the summit, and I asked him, what support can Ukraine expect?
The first thing on Ukraine's list is air defences, more Patriot batteries, which are capable of taking down the cruise missiles that were fired in that mass attack recently. There is going to be a specific pledge about providing Ukraine with more military assistance for the next year, at least $40 billion worth of military aid for 2025. There was a hope Jens Stoltenberg had that he could persuade NATO allies to have an agreement to a long-term commitment of 5 years for military assistance to Ukraine. But he hasn't been able to achieve that, not least because of the political uncertainties here in Washington about what might happen or not in this year's presidential election, and also some European countries too not able to commit to a share of their GDP to commit to Ukraine. So there won't be that long-term support, but certainly a long-term signal of support for Ukraine in terms of providing it with weapons, but also about its future being inside the NATO alliance. Of course, it's been clear that whilst this war goes on, despite Ukraine's desire to join NATO, it's not going to happen until the fighting stops.
And how disappointing is that for Ukraine?
You know, inevitably, Ukraine always comes to these NATO meetings with high hopes and leaves slightly disappointed. I suspect it will leave slightly disappointed, but overall, the message from NATO is that they are fully behind Ukraine. I mean, it's not every single ally, of course. Viktor Orban from Hungary has been visiting President Putin, and there's a lot of criticism from NATO allies of what he's been doing. But broadly speaking, there is a sense of unity. But the elephant in the room here is what's going to happen in the US. I mean, there'll be all eyes on, first of all, Joe Biden, on how he performs after his pretty disastrous presidential debate. But I don't think they will address in public what could happen next, and they will not be entertaining or discussing in public, although they'll all be thinking about it. What would they do if Donald Trump, a known skeptic of providing military support, US military money to Ukraine and also the alliance itself, wins the second term? Those concerns are real here, even though they won't be addressed in public.
Jonathan Beale. Well, earlier on the podcast, we heard President Biden's forcefully delivered message, in contrast to his halting performance in the television debate last week with Donald Trump, which caused huge concern among Democrats. Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader in the House of Representatives, has held a meeting with colleagues who remain worried about President Biden's bid for the White House in November. The president has admitted his performance at the debate was poor, but insists he is staying in the race. These voters had mixed views.
I feel he has done so much. I will support him out of loyalty. And I will vote for him if he's on the ticket.
I think he should step aside for sure. I'm a lifelong Democrat, but it's like, I think at this point, 100% chance right now that Trump wins if he runs.
Our correspondent in Washington, Nomer Iqbal, told me more about the meetings in which the Democrats in Congress discussed Mr. Biden's future.
You had the House Democrats and the Senate Democrats meeting behind closed doors to talk about their concerns regarding President Biden's health. Now, the House Democrats have been much more vocal. You've got several members who have called on President Biden to stand down. And many of them left the meeting, not saying much, but there was, you know, from various reports, we had a team on the Capitol who said that the atmosphere wasn't great. There are those who are still concerned. In terms of the Senate Democrats, there haven't been any that have explicitly called for the president to stand down, but they've not really coalesced around him either. So really where things stand is that the president is showing signs of a political life again and a political fight back. I'm actually sat in the White House press briefing room where the questions were asked once again about President Biden's health. The press secretary doubled down and said that the president is going nowhere. And the focus is very much on the big NATO summit this week, where the president is hosting world leaders. But everything he says, everything he does is going to be hugely scrutinised.
How long have they got before they can decide whether to stick with him, President Biden, for the election in November, or they can decide to try and change things?
Well, we're talking about a matter of weeks, to be honest, because the Democratic National Convention is mid-August, and by that point he will be confirmed as the nominee. But, you know, there have been talks about an open convention. I mean, open conventions were once upon a time a thing. They haven't been, you know, obviously used for a long time now. But the Democrats who are standing by President Biden say that this would be too chaotic, that this, you know, wouldn't be the way to do things. And also, President Biden has won the primaries, and there are delegates who back him, and it would all become very, very complicated. Then there's the question of who would replace him. But the crucial point here is that the only way the president can be replaced is if he stands down. And he has made it very clear that's not going to happen. You know, as far as the president's concerned and those who support him, it's a case of the matter's closed. At the press briefing today, the White House press secretary said that those who are concerned about President Biden want him to step aside, those numbers are much smaller compared to those who still want him to run again.
Nomer Iqbal in Washington. Now to Russia, where the crackdown on critics of the Kremlin continues. A court in Moscow has issued an arrest warrant for Yulia Navalny, the widow of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. After his suspicious death in an Arctic Circle prison in February, his wife took over as leader of his anti-corruption foundation, a designated extremist group in Russia. Will Vernon has more.
She's accused of carrying out crimes under the criminal code, so that's a serious criminal offence in Russia. And the charge is participation in an extremist group, and she's now been placed on the wanted list. Now, of course, Yulia Navalny is not in Russia at the moment. She is in the West. We don't know exactly where she's living, where she's residing at the moment. For obvious reasons, she doesn't broadcast that, but she left Russia not long after her husband was poisoned by Novichok in 2020. After Alexei Navalny died in February this year, Yulia Navalny got up in front of a hall full of delegates at the Munich Security Conference and criticised the Russian authorities in general for being responsible for her husband's death, but also pointing the finger directly at Vladimir Putin.
Will Vernon. Yulia Navalny posted her response to the arrest warrant on the social media platform X. Here it is, voiced by one of our journalists.
When you write about this, please do not forget to write the main thing. Vladimir Putin is a murderer and a war criminal. His place is in prison, and not somewhere in The Hague in a cosy cell with a TV, but in Russia, in the same colony and the same 2x3 metre cell in which he killed Alexei.
The words of Yulia Navalny. Well, meanwhile, the wife of Vladimir Karamurza, the jailed Russian opposition politician, says his lawyer has again been denied access to him. Nothing has been heard from Mr. Karamurza since the Russian authorities said he'd been transferred to hospital for an examination on July the 4th. Vladimir Karamurza received a 25-year prison sentence for treason last year after speaking out against President Putin and the war in Ukraine. A political activist in Gaza has been beaten by armed men after speaking out against the Hamas authorities there. Amin Abed, a long-time opponent of Hamas, had just criticised the group on social media. He recently spoke to television networks, including to the BBC. Friends say all four of his limbs were broken in the attack. He's now recovering in hospital. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Lucy Williamson.
Already paying the price of war, Amin Abed was made to pay the price of protest. Video footage taken just after yesterday's attack shows him on the ground, barely moving, his limbs marked by bloodied wounds. Speaking exclusively to the BBC from his hospital bed, he said that five masked men with knives, axes and pistols had kidnapped and beaten him, calling him a traitor and an agent for Israel. Their leader told them to break my fingers, to stop me writing anything against Hamas again, he said. Friends told the BBC that the armed men were members of the Hamas internal security force and that Amin's life was saved by local women who pushed through bursts of gunfire from his attackers to make them stop. Afterwards, his father walked through the streets with a loudspeaker calling on Amin's attackers. Enough, you cowards, he said. Did you win victory by kidnapping and beating my son? Amin, an outspoken critic of Hamas for many years, has been arrested and beaten before. This attack came days after television channels, including the BBC, broadcast interviews with him, and hours after he sharply criticised Hamas on social media, accusing the group of kidnapping Gaza and clinging to power by fighting until the last child.
Lucy Williamson. The United Nations Human Rights Office says it's looking into reports of a mass grave along the Libya-Tunisia border. The High Commissioner, Volker Türk, said the responsibility for investigating the alleged crimes falls squarely on Libya.
In March this year, a mass grave was discovered in southwestern Libya containing at least 65 bodies presumed to be migrants. As if this were not horrific enough, we are following up on reports of another mass grave recently discovered in the desert area at the Libyan-Tunisian border. I urge the authorities to respond swiftly to our inquiries and to investigate these crimes fully.
Mr. Turk also called on the international community to suspend cooperation on asylum and migration with authorities involved in human rights violations. Both Libya and Tunisia are vital partners in the European Union's efforts to stem the flow of migrants across the Mediterranean from North Africa into southern Europe. You're listening to the Global News Podcast with me, Valerie Sanderson. Still to come, the actor Alec Baldwin's involuntary manslaughter trial begins in New Mexico. And
now you can actually go on a free kayak tour and collect waste. I mean, where can you do that?
The Danish city where tourists are being encouraged to go green.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the surprise election result in France that has put left-wing coalition, the New Popular Front, on top. So who are the left leaders? What do they want? And what does this result mean for French President Emmanuel Macron? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
It was an incident that rocked the film industry. 3 years ago, the actor Alec Baldwin was on set for the film Rust when the prop gun he was holding went off, killing the cinematographer Helena Hutchins. Now, the trial of the Hollywood star has begun in the US state of New Mexico, where he stands accused of involuntary manslaughter, a charge that Mr. Baldwin denies. The actor declined to speak to reporters as he arrived in court in Santa Fe.
Mr. Baldwin, are you feeling confident today? Are you going to be a free man in 2 weeks, Mr. Baldwin?
I spoke to our correspondent, Emma Vardy, as the proceedings got underway on Tuesday.
Jury selection has just got going and that's supposed to take the rest of today. So, of course, that's that process where the prosecutors and defence get to question a group of people and then they can pick their jury from that, and they're essentially looking to try to get people who can be fair and impartial. Now, Mr. Baldwin, he's sat in court today, he's watching that process, but really tomorrow is when things really kick off and that's when the opening arguments will happen. Now, the question that's at the heart of this case really is, did Mr. Baldwin act responsibly when he was handling that weapon? We know he said that the crew told him the weapon was safe, much as you'd expect. The armourer who was responsible for handling weapons on set, Hannah Gutierrez, she was previously already found guilty of involuntary manslaughter. So in that sense, there is somebody else he can point the finger at and say, look, the armourer was the person who made the big mistake in this case, which was that she had mixed up live bullets with dummy rounds, and that's why this gun then fired a live round, causing the tragic death of the cinematographer. But what the prosecution say is that actually Alec Baldwin was responsible too. They say that you should never point a gun at somebody. Those are basic safety rules with a gun. You should never point a gun at someone and pull the trigger unless you're intending to kill them. And they say that it was Hannah Gutierrez's mistake, the armourer, was one part of this, but the other part of it was that Alec Baldwin himself wasn't following safety rules and that he should also share some of the responsibility.
Now, this incident happened 3 years ago, didn't it? What has Alec Baldwin been doing since then?
Well, what we know from some court documents previously is that he said he's found things very difficult, that he's struggled to find acting work since then. He has just signed up to do a reality series with him and his family. Clearly, he has some intentions that he will be a free man after this trial. But we'll have to wait and see the outcome of it. But clearly, life has been made extremely difficult for him with this hanging over him, because this shooting at the time, it shocked the film industry. It's made many, many headlines. Lots of people speculating on whether it was right to bring him to trial, whether he is or isn't responsible. And Alec Baldwin himself gave a couple of interviews after the incident, trying to set out his defence case, really, and saying that he didn't pull the trigger, that it's the responsibility of crew members, particularly the armourer, of course, to hand weapons to actors and make sure they're safe. But you can imagine life has been extremely difficult because, of course, people make up their own judgments in the court of public opinion. And as an actor looking to find work, it's clearly affected his career so far. So he's going to be hoping that this is the end of this at this trial. But we'll have to wait and see what the jury make of the evidence.
Emma Vardy. Almost 230 million girls and women around the world, more than half of them in Africa, have undergone some form of female genital mutilation. That's the partial or total removal of external female genital organs for non-medical reasons. Shamsa Sharawi and Hadja Bilkisu had corrective surgery in Europe to repair the physical damage done to them as children. But the procedure isn't available in most African countries. Now, the BBC's Bushra Mohammed has met Shamsa and Hadja and spoken to them both about their experiences. A warning, this report contains details which you may find upsetting.
This is my mom, that's my sister, and that's me.
Shamsa Sharawi, a 31-year-old British Somali, sits cross-legged on her bed. She is swiping through old photos of herself on the phone.
We were applying for a visa to come to the UK.
Looking through childhood photos brings up painful memories for Shamsa. At just 6 years of age, while living in Somalia, she became a victim of female genital mutilation. She was pinned down by family members as her clitoris, vulva and labia were cut, and then she was sewn shut.
I had chronic pain. I was not able to wear underwear or trousers. I was not able to walk comfortably or sit comfortably. And I just got to a point where my mental health was really deteriorating.
Shamsa now works to raise awareness on the dangers of FGM. Walking through her local park, she told me about the decision to undergo reconstructive surgery 2 decades later.
The idea of being cut again was daunting, to say the least. I was absolutely terrified, but I knew in order for me to live comfortably in my body, I had to have the surgery.
Despite raising tens of thousands of dollars to cover the surgery in Germany, she is still in debt.
Is crippling, knowing that you are now in debt for something you did not do to yourself, for a crime that was done against you, and you have to now carry that load is very tough.
Shamsa is not alone in her experience. Over 800 kilometers away in Germany, 30-year-old Sri Leonean Hadja Bilkisu also opted for surgery 3 years ago. She was cut when she was 8 years old in a hospital under anesthesia and doesn't recall the experience.
I always felt like I'm a visitor in my own body and this body doesn't belong to me because it was taken away from me.
The surgery didn't cost her much because it was done under Germany's public healthcare system. She did, however, have to undergo several procedures to get the results she hoped for.
I couldn't walk properly for 2 or 3 weeks. I couldn't lay down on my side for 2 or 3 weeks. And emotionally and mentally, I think that's the most challenging part. Because after a surgery like that, you are basically re-traumatized.
The procedure is only available in a few African countries, such as Kenya, where women must pay out of their own pockets, and in Egypt, where non-governmental organizations may sometimes help with the costs. Dr. Rahim Awad, based in Cairo, Egypt, is one of the few reconstructive surgeons in Africa.
I always explain to my patients that we can never remake or restore everything as it was originally, because it's not just about the physical aspects that have been removed, but it's also about restoring that woman's self-confidence and overcome the trauma of what she went through.
In Africa alone, more than 140 million women and girls have undergone FGM. Now in recovery, both Shamsa and Hadja say they are happy with their decisions.
I feel for the first time in my life, normality. And for a survivor of FGM, I have never felt normality.
But they both believe it is not a decision they would recommend without serious thoughts on the risks involved.
Bushra Mohammed. It is summer in the Northern Hemisphere and many people are looking forward to holidays abroad. Sunbathing, sightseeing and swimming are favourites on the holiday activity list. But what about picking up litter. Well, the tourism board in Denmark's capital, Copenhagen, are trialling a scheme to encourage greener tourism, where visitors can earn CopenPay points for taking part in sustainable activities. In turn, they'll qualify for free cultural visits and even food and drink. Paul Henley spoke to the director of the scheme, Rikke Holm Petersen.
We have big ambitions for a sustainable transition of our destination the coming years. And of course, that's a big task. And one of the things we really want to is turning tourism from being an environmental burden into a force for positive change. And data actually shows that 82% say they want to act sustainably, but only 22% have changed their behavior. So one of the reasons why we started this trial was actually diminishing this big gap. So we want to change the mindset and actions of tourists and nudge them towards more green choices. So one of the things they can do, they can collect waste, plastic waste, and then they are being invited to a workshop to turn it into art. They can go to a place called Øens Have, which is the largest urban farm in Northern Europe. And then they can work in the garden and earn a free vegetarian lunch with CopenPay. So there are many different things you can do and also many different awards.
Does it involve a lot of trust? Can someone turn up and say, I've been riding around the city on a bike, so can I have my free entry to this tourist attraction? How will the people know?
The system in itself is based on trust that we decided on very quickly because Denmark is a society of trust. So participation is quite simple. In some of the attractions, you show proof of your green actions, and that could be a train ticket or a bicycle or whatever it is. And in other places, they won't ask for it. So it differs a bit.
It's not everybody's idea of a holiday highlight, picking up plastic litter, but you're optimistic it'll catch on?
Yes, for sure. Because imagine, when you go on vacay yourself, you normally do your normal things. You go to a museum or you go to places. Now you're actually being presented for something different. Now you can actually go on a free kayak tour and collect waste. I mean, where can you do that? And you can do it for free. Or you can go to an urban farm and work there a couple of hours and get a free meal. I would actually say you enrich your holiday by doing this. So you get a lot more out of your holiday and you get some other experiences than what you would normally do.
Rikke Holm Petersen. And finally, the European Space Agency's much-anticipated Ariane 6 rocket has taken off from French Guiana on its Virgin flight. This is the moment the rocket launched.
3, 2, 1, top! Allumage 2SR, décollage!
That was liftoff. Well, at a cost of more than $4 billion, the rocket is intended to give European governments and companies access to space independently from the rest of the world and is seen as the biggest competitor to Elon Musk's SpaceX. Dr. Simeon Barber is a space scientist at the Open University.
The first launch of any new rocket is always the trickiest one. It's the one where your heart is beating as fast as it gets. And it was definitely an exciting one this evening. And as far as we've seen, everything seems to be going OK so far.
And why is this rocket so important?
This is a really important rocket for Europe, really. Its predecessor had done 115 successful missions out of 117. So it had been a really good workhorse launcher for European spacecraft and for space instruments that I've developed at the Open University. But times change and you've got to move on to the next model. And its predecessor retired a year ago, and we had no launch capability in Europe, and now we have one again. So it's building that capability to put payloads into space for the future.
And what will it be used for primarily?
This will be used for all sorts of satellites to go either orbiting the Earth, maybe looking, taking images, high-resolution images, doing telecommunications, making mobile phones work, studying the weather. And it'll also be used to send spacecraft into space, so missions to the moon, for instance.
And Elon Musk has already criticised the company, hasn't he? Is that because it's seen as a big competitor to his SpaceX?
Certainly. Space launching is, becoming a very competitive business. And one of the key characteristics of what SpaceX do is that they're aiming for almost fully reusable spacecraft. Ariane 6 has some reusable elements, but not all of it. So it may not be as sustainable in the future, in the long term. So, you know, the question will be, can it capture a market and do launches reliably, but also cost effectively? Because there's a lot more competition in the space launching market now than there was, say, maybe 10 years ago when this was being planned.
And what does it tell us about the future of the European Space Agency?
I think European Space Agency wants to have its own access to space, and that benefits Europe as a whole. And, you know, the investment that goes into that is returned into, you know, European economies. It's able to compete on the global market again. Time will tell just to how competitive this generation of spacecraft will be.
Dr. Simeon Barber. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Fox. The producer was Isabella Jewell. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Saunderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the surprise election result in France that has put left-wing coalition, the New Popular Front, on top. So who are the left leaders? What do they want? And what does this result mean for French President Emmanuel Macron? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.